It's always a pleasure to welcome Dave Eggers to our program. His latest book, The Captain and the Glory and Entertainment, is a very funny novel which tells the story of a noble ship, the Glory, and the loud, clownish, and foul captain who steers it to the brink of disaster. When the decorated captain of this great ship descends the gangplank for the final time, a new leader, a man with a yellow feather in his hair, vows to step forward. Though he has no experience, no knowledge of nautical navigation or maritime law, and though he has often remarked he doesn't much like boats, he solemnly swears to shake things up. The satire is absurd, hilarious, and all too recognizable. The Captain and the Glory is a farce of contemporary America. Dave Eggers is the author of 12 books, including The Parade, The Circle, Heroes of the Frontier, and a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. He is the founder of McSweeney's, an independent publishing company, and co-founder of Voice of Witness, a book series that uses oral history to illuminate human rights crisis around the world. Dave Eggers, again, is the author of The Captain and the Glory. Thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having me on.
So this is an entertainment. This is a satire. This is a parody. At what point did you start to think that this is the story you wanted to tell?
Well, probably 6 months after the inauguration, or maybe after the election. I think I, like a lot of people, try to figure out how to respond, how to understand, or how to sublimate or translate what had happened. And so for a long time, I toggled between approaching it journalistically and trying to think of, like, maybe a more fictional, more allegorical approach to it. So I sort of played with it for almost 2 years before finally finishing it and thinking that it did have some kind of place among all of the verbiage that's been devoted to this strange era.
During the election in 2016, you were covering this. You were covering the campaign as a journalist. And what did you come across? Did you see something there that you said, oh, this is interesting?
I think, like a lot of people, I was stunned by the popularity and persistence of Trump during the campaign. I think every time he cleared another hurdle or every time another rival was subsumed or ground to dust by his campaign, I was shocked. And so I finally went to a rally in Sacramento in August of 2016. It was one of the few appearances Trump made here in California. And I went up there just to sort of see it. But even at that point, though I think that everyone knew he would get the nomination, nobody thought he really had a chance against Clinton. And so I went there just as a curiosity more than anything else. But I found the crowd there, I thought it would be sort of a very fringe, frothing, brown shirt sort of crowd, or at least I had been led to believe that by the pictures and video that I'd seen online. But what I found was a very broad swath of Northern California, this is near Sacramento. I thought it was much more calm, good-humored, sort of passively curious, more diverse, and more sort of reasonable than I thought possible at a Trump rally. And I came away thinking that he could win because he was appealing to a much broader swath of the population than I had assumed. And so that's been the case at every Trump rally that I've been to since, and I think I've been to maybe four since then. And every one of them, I keep finding the crowd having a very similar vibe to, like, minor league baseball games that I go to. It's a much sort of calmer, festive atmosphere. There's a lot of dancing, weirdly, at these rallies. They play a lot of Village People and Elton John and Rolling Stones, and people dance in their seats before Trump gets on. I mean, it's kind of, and it isn't sort of a fascist hate fest that I thought that these rallies would be. And so I think, and now, You know, the last rally I went to in Hershey, Pennsylvania, was the same day that the articles of impeachment were handed down. And, you know, I interviewed a lot of people afterward, pretty broad swath of people. And now Trump has a record to run on, an economic record that's sort of hard to argue with. You know, though so many of these people that come to the rallies or have voted for him or are considering voting for him this time, and, you know, there's all kinds of people that come because it's a free show in right. their hometown. You know, it's the same way you'd go and see the circus if it comes to town and you can get a ticket for free. You know, they see real benefit personally as a result of his economic policies, and that's going to be hard to run on, especially in states like Pennsylvania.
So the reasonableness that you just described is very counter to what you write about in this book.
Yeah, you know, I toggle between really enjoying my conversations with Trump supporters, and I really do, because every single person I've talked to has been really open, very candid, candid about their reservations about Trump and the way that they balance things and in their mind and the cognitive dissonance that it sometimes takes to support somebody that has lived a life very counter to kind of bedrock American Christian values. Or, you know, I'm saying so because I think most of the people I interviewed at this last rally were talked a lot about faith. And so and I've interviewed a lot of faith leaders who support Trump and how strange that is sometimes to sort of balance those two things. His obviously aberrant or un-Christian behavior and ungenerous way of life, I guess, with the fact that they've chosen him as their vessel. But I come back from a rally and I think about, like, you know, okay, this is a malleable electorate. They are reasonable. They actually could be convinced to vote elsewhere. And I come away thinking, okay, everyone is so reasonable. But then I back up a few steps and I think, what am I doing? Like, I often forget just how absurd the time is and how bizarre and unprecedented this era is, and how ludicrous this human is, and so I sometimes think that in a sober-minded kind of reasonable piece of journalism, I'm not really always reflecting just how insane the era is, and how we will look back on it as one of the most ludicrous times in American history. And sometimes getting into the weeds of it and talking to individuals and feeling so encouraged by their reasonableness, I forget just how the ludicrous shape of it all. And so I thought with Captain of the Glory I would get at that and be able to sort of back up a bit and describe it in its most sort of heightened terms. And I think satire or this kind of combination of satire and allegory might best reflect that, might be a better mirror for the moment than straight-up journalism.
Dave Eggers is our guest. The name of the book is The Captain and the Glory, and Entertainment. I assume you use that word in entertainment deliberately.
Yeah, that subtitle arrived really late in, I think it was a few weeks before the book went to press. I was reading Graham Greene's The Comedians, and he had subtitled that, you know, that book, An Entertainment, and he did so for a lot of his novels. And I just thought it was a perfect, I don't know, sort of, it set the tone perfectly, I thought, because it's, in this case, The Captain of the Glory is, I hoped, to make an entertaining book that actually gave a kind of catharsis, or allowed us to laugh at ourselves and at our moment and what we've made of our country. But at the same time, it has quite a bit of horror in it. And I wanted an entertainment to be kind of like a dubious invitation to the reader, where you think maybe it will be all lighthearted and relatively innocuous, but the last third of the book, it gets increasingly dark and sort of unvarnished, I think, about the real human cost of these last few years, and how, besides the economic indicators that many of which are positive, we've sort of institutionalized cruelty and made compassion and empathy kind of superfluous or even anti-American values. And so I wanted to get at that, and I think an entertainment kind of has a, I don't know, I mean, it's obviously used ironically, I guess, to, right. to really put a, to underline it, yeah.
You set the book, of course, on a ship, and there's a, so there's a very, that's very contained just
yeah.
by doing that. You contain it.
Yeah, I thought, not that I ever really considered setting this in D.C., because there's just no way to satirize what happens every day. You could never get out in front of it enough. but changing the scenery, changing the venue, having a new set of rules, a smaller cast of characters, and having them all on a ship in the middle of the sea, stuck with each other, I thought created a necessary tension and a set of constraints that you really need, I think, for fiction. And so having all of these people, half of whom support the election of this captain, who has never captained a ship, doesn't have any interest in ships, degrades all of the previous captains and the functioning of the engine room, everything. You know, half of the passengers decide that this person, known for selling cheap souvenirs by the pool, is the one to lead the ship and entrust with all of their safety. I thought was a good setup and maybe, you know, the best corollary for our time. And then, but having the two factions, those that support the captain and those that are appalled by him, stuck with each other on this, you know, on this vessel, surrounded by unforgiving sea, I thought it sort of created the, it was a setup that allowed for a lot of drama and also comedy, because cruise ships like this one are inherently silly, and much of what happens on a cruise ship is silly, and you have shuffleboard and disco nights, and and I thought it to start with a silly premise and atmosphere and context, and then be able to insert relentless human drama and horror or increasingly gave me sort of, I don't know, I liked the contrast there, and I thought it would and again, it's the way we live now. I think every day we have the most silly and the most comical and cartoonish aspects of politics in display, but underneath it all there is there are children in cages, there are people dying in horrific conditions on the border, and we have just a snake charmer's sort of bringing out the hatred and the cruelty and the passive complicity in all of this and in so many, so much of the country. And so I wanted both of those aspects to coexist, and having it in this very contained setting made it possible.
There are, of course, differences, but I was struck in reading it that if you were in a bookstore in Sussex, England, and you picked up a copy of this, and you would say, "Oh, look, a book about Boris Johnson."
Right. Well, it's weird. Ian McEwan published The Cockroach around the same time, or I became aware of it when this book was maybe being finished at the printer. I saw Ian McEwan at a festival in England, and he had just finished The Cockroach, and I had just finished this, and we sort of talked about how, you know, the projects that we both undertook, which were, you know, shorter allegorical novels about our countries at these critical and very strange moments of sort of self-destruction in a way. And but there are so many parallels. You know, we are similar countries in a lot of ways. Our aging population has a sort of a similarly fearful sense that they're being threatened or their primacy is being eroded. And I think that in both cases, they lashed out, sort of exercised their power at the ballot box, but recklessly and self-destructively in a way. And so I think that, but the fact that that both of our countries have very clownish, pseudo-blonde, buffoonish leaders leading us is a coincidence that's you could never put in a novel. It would never be believed. And so I think that we don't really grasp how strange this moment is. I think we're still not seeing the forest for the trees. And but I think we'll be unpacking this for a century afterward. What happened? Why? What does it say about us? And can we ever get back to a place where we take ourselves seriously?
Do you think, to use the word entertainment, do you think it becomes more entertaining assuming that there is a happy ending? Do you know what I mean? If
yeah.
that if in 4, 8, 12 years, we're not where we are now.
Yeah, that was one of the pleasures of writing this, is that I could write an ending to the time, and the reader can get there in 150 pages, as opposed to the real situation we're in, where we really don't know when this will end and how and what will become. So, you know, it's one of the joys of reading is that satisfaction of a story having a beginning, middle, and end, and an end that is somehow satisfying or restorative, cathartic. And so I actually was healing myself in a way, or telling myself a story with that ending, because the ending is optimistic, and I do have optimism that we will refind our dignity as a country. And this is not Republican or Democrat, it's because I really think that there are plenty of Republican elected leaders who would make fine presidents. But this is about the dignity of the country and our self-knowledge about who we're supposed to be. And I think that is being forgotten on the one hand and aggressively rewritten on another hand by the Steve Bannons and Steve Millers of the world. Mm-hmm. And so I think, but I do really, I'm so optimistic about us. And what's funny is that it's meeting Trump voters that makes me optimistic, because everyone I've met has been so likable and so malleable. We have long discussions where we come back to the values that we share. We come back to our mutual hopes and what we believe in, and we like each other quite a bit. And I think that if for whatever reason, so many millions of people have been sort of caught in what I can only think of as a fever. It was Jeff Flake, actually. I interviewed him after a rally in Arizona, and he talked about it as a fever. This is before he quit the Senate, as a fever that the nation is afflicted with. It'll break at some point, but we are in the middle of a fever, just as the country was under McCarthy and a few other times in the 20th century. But eventually that fever breaks, and we refind ourselves and we heal ourselves. and we get back to our better selves.
The name of the new book is The Captain and the Glory. It is published by Knopf. Dave Eggers, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Captain and the Glory, an entertainment. It is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.